Reading from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 17. Jesus said, "I say to you truly, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from hence to yonder place,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." I get the idea that Jesus was a big fan of mustard seeds for some reason. This is the second time he uses it, and presumably since all the stories of Jesus were not written down, he used it more than that. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the other parable of the mustard seed, where he talks about it growing into the greatest of shrubs, such that the birds can come and make nests in its shade. A very peaceful, edifying image. This one's used as a rebuke, and I can just hear the disciples saying to themselves, "Oh, here comes the mustard seed thing again." Because he says to the disciples, who had just been brought someone who was, in the words of the text, possessed by a demon, and they could do nothing about it, seemingly. For the people bring the person to Jesus and say, "Your disciples couldn't help. What about you?" At which point Jesus says to his disciples, "If you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, 'Move from hence to yonder place,' and nothing will be impossible for you." You will say to this mountain, you will use your words. Last week, we used a whisper to define and illustrate the gift of hope, as in whispering hope. Today, the candle of peace, the Sunday of peace, the image of peace, I think, can be illustrated and pondered a bit. Again, with an audible, that is, this day, talking peace, whispering hope, talking peace. Peace as a sense of well-being, as a condition that moves us forward. The result of using words. I remember the Paris peace talks that started and were protracted for several years that ultimately brought an end to the Vietnam War. Ultimately, because it took a while. They spent a lot of time talking about seemingly silly things. It took them months to agree on the shape of the table. It took them another protracted period of time to agree on where in the room the table should be, what kind of chairs we should have around it, who should sit where, etc., ad nauseum. Well, it strikes me in retrospect that the silliness of that might have been a process by which we build some trust. If we can agree on the little things, maybe it's worth talking about some of the big things. And it, though it took years, Henry Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho, representing the North Vietnamese, won together and shared the Nobel Peace Prize. And the cover of Time and Newsweek, when that deal was struck, said peace with honor, the result of peace talks, and the mountain of warfare moved from hence to yonder place, and gives us a sense of hope, even in the midst now of protracted warfare. Maybe if we can get to talking, we can experience again peace. Well, there are mountains, emotional mountains, in our own lives that this text can be brought to bear through understanding, that this gift of peace can be experienced. We have mountains of resentment. We have mountains of anger. We have mountains of misunderstanding, emotions that infect our relationships with others. Imagine just the people you know casually. The people perhaps you work with from time to time, or perhaps have to meet on a regular basis, that now and then, or maybe more often than not, drive you a little bit nuts. People with whom you disagree, socially, vocationally, ideologically, politically. Even disagreeable people that you can't avoid completely. It would be nice if we could, and that's not a bad strategy, to avoid disagreeable people. But when you must converse, and the mountain of resentment is built over time, there are specific words, talking peace, that can move that mountain, if only a little. We teach it to our 2-year-olds, the magic words please and thank you. But beneath it, a process of encountering one another with courtesy and respect. And even disagreeable people, and you can even use this strategically if you don't believe it, are worthy of respect, simply because they are. So moving the mountain of resentment as in, boy, the next time I see him, that just hurts you. Please and thank you, polite conversation, courtesy, and in the course of interacting, stick to the issue. There are issues at work and other places where we have to move forward the organization or even our tasks. Talking peace, words that move mountains from hence to yonder place, polite and courteous, sticking to the issues on one level. Not to mention the people that love us the most. Don't they drive you nuts from time to time?
He makes me so mad. She just infuriates me.
Well, you know, there's a pretty profound psychological theory that says nobody makes us feel anything without our permission. Now, it's hard to short-circuit that permission in some ways. An interesting theory that anger, which really does infect even our closest relationships, the people we love the most, can make us the maddest. Not without our permission. Because anger, at least theoretically, is the second thing we feel when they make us so mad. It's actually a feeling that, almost without thinking, we choose. Men are especially prone to this in a society that values what we come to understand as masculinity. There's really only one acceptable feeling at all, and that's anger, righteous anger, enraged, and so on. But when you peel it apart, especially when you are at odds with or angry in the company of someone who loves you very much and you love them back, there's something else typically underneath it that anger is actually safer to feel because it pushes them away and then you can regroup. Underneath the anger is very likely one of these three things. Instead of saying I'm furious, what we're really saying is I'm scared. I am scared to death. I'm afraid. Or I'm feeling pretty guilty about something. Fear, guilt, or I'm helpless. I can't fix this. I can't change it. So instead of helplessness, guilt, or fear, anger is a little safer. In the company of someone you love and who loves you back, experiencing the gift of peace comes in the talking out of what's underneath the obvious. I'm scared about that. When that happened and you did this, it scared me to death. Me too. When that happened and you did this and I did that, I felt horrible about what I did to you. I'm sorry. When that happened and you did this and I did that, I felt out of control. I couldn't fix something and I wish I could. Saying the words out loud, I couldn't fix it. I'm sorry. I'm afraid. Are words that move mountains, mountains of anger, because that's no longer what we have to feel in order to move the relationship forward. I'm sorry. I'm scared. I'm a little out of control, and you know, we're all in this together, and the mountain moves from hence to yonder place. With casual acquaintances, people with whom we need to interact, the disagreeable ones especially, and friends and lovers. And also, peace talks are appropriate when you're having a conversation with yourself, or need to. It's not easy to admit this, but sometimes we look in the mirror, we look into our own eyes, and in our head comes the phrase, "What is wrong with you? Are you crazy?" And all we wind up feeling is more and more depressed, which, interestingly enough, according to Freud, is anger turned inward. So now we've got the whole anger dynamic working inside ourselves. It's been intriguing to me, a little bit frightening, to watch some of the responses that our students are providing us on our survey. These are, by and large, 18 to 20-year-olds. And we're asking them questions about their sense of self or their level of depression or even their image of themselves. You know, to what extent do you agree or strongly agree that you're a person of worth? To what extent do you agree or strongly agree that you can do things as well as most other people? And, you know, we get 85 or so percent agreement on that, which means there's 15% of 18 to 20-year-olds that are just, and that are by and large successful because they're all college students, telling themselves at least part of the time what's wrong with you. And then the one that really intrigues me, to what extent are you dissatisfied with your body? And again, 15 to 20% say moderately to very dissatisfied. Now, these are 18 to 20-year-olds who will never, at least by conventional standards, look that good again. And yet they've been taught through media, through models, through magazine covers of people who are extraordinarily airbrushed or otherwise enhanced, that if you don't look like this, there's something wrong with you. What can you possibly say to yourself when you've got that input? Well, you could hear the words of Jesus himself, in effect coming from the cross, "You were worth this much." For Jesus himself is the quintessential gift of Advent and Christmas. He is God incarnate. He is God choosing to become human and to feel all of these emotions. The Epistle to the Hebrews qualifies this slightly, saying that Jesus was human in every respect except for sin. And we sort of interpret that, I think, rather simplistically by saying, okay, Jesus was fully human and he experienced everything we do, but he didn't sin. In other words, he didn't call anybody names. He probably didn't get mad. Well, actually, he did when he cleansed the temple. But he never got married, you know. Without sin, as though it involved Jesus' behavior. I think that defines the distinction between Jesus and us too narrowly. Sin, properly understood, has some to do, but not most profoundly to do with behavior. It has to do with the condition of being separated from God. The condition of being separated from God. And the distinguishing feature about the incarnate Jesus, the Jesus child and man, is that he's the only human being that was still human and yet intimately connected with the God who he not only was and represented, but who created him and chose to be a human being. That's how Jesus is human without sin, is that he's still got that connection to God, and in so doing, gives us the bridge across that chasm of estrangement. And most profoundly, it comes when he himself talks peace at the Last Supper. "Take and eat. It is my body given for you, the blood shed for you." We reenact that pretty regularly in the course of our life together, so that you hear a quote from Jesus talking peace. And the mountain of self-doubt, the mountain of inward anger, begins to move from hence to yonder place when the blood of Christ shed for you, when the body of Christ is given for you, and the not so subtle, in fact, the direct in your face in the mirror message to you from Jesus himself is, "You're worth it. You were worth this." The hymn, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," is so enduring and popular because it illustrates the way that we are connected to the one who builds a bridge between us and the estrangement of sin from the Father. Take it to the Lord in prayer. Take it inside you as you experience this together. Words that move mountains. Words that speak peace. Please and thank you and other courtesies. I'm afraid. I'm sorry. We're in this together and we can't control it. And most profoundly of all, take and eat. Take it to the Lord in prayer. You're worth it. Talking peace. Amen.